always wear rubbish to work. She looks like she's cracking a joke with her clothes." They sat around the oval conference table in Auntie Onenu's large office. Auntie Onenu's weave was longer and more incongruous than the last, high and coiffed in front, with waves of hair floating to her back. She sipped from a bottle of Diet Sprite and said she liked Doris's piece, "Marrying Your Best Friend."
"Very good and inspirational," she said.
"Ah, but Auntie Onenu, women should not marry their best friend because there is no sexual chemistry," the Maie said.
Auntie Onenu gave the Maie the look given to the crazy student, whom one could not take seriously. Then she shuffled her papers and said she did not like Ifemelu's profile of Mrs. Fumi King.
"Why did you see she never looks at her steward when she speaks to him?"
Auntie Onenu asked.
"Because she didn't," Ifemelu said.
"But it makes her sound wicked,"
Auntie Onenu said.
"I think it's an interesting detail," Ifemelu said.
"I agree with Auntie Onenu," Doris said. "Interesting or not, it is judgmental."
"The idea of interviewing someone and writing a profile is judgmental," Ifemelu said. "It's not about the subject. It's about what the interviewer makes of the subject." Auntie Onenu shook her head. Doris shook her head. "Why do we have to play it so safe?" Ifemelu asked.
Doris said with false humor, "This isn't your American race blog, where you provoked everybody, Ifemelu. This is like a wholesome women's magazine."
"Yes, it is," Auntie Onenu said.
"But Auntie Onenu, we will never beat glass if we continue like this," Ifemelu said.
Auntie Onenu's eyes widened.
"Glass is doing exactly what we're doing," Doris said quickly.
Esther came in to tell Auntie Onenu that her daughter had arrived. Esther's black high heels were shaky, and as she walked past, Ifemelu worried that the shoes would collapse and sprain Esther's ankles. Earlier in the morning, Esther had told Ifemelu,
"Auntie, your hair is jagga jagga,"
with a kind of sad honesty about what Ifemelu considered an attractive twist-out style.
"Hey, she's already here," Auntie Onenu said. "Gauss, please finish the meeting. I am taking my daughter to shop for a dress, and I have an afternoon meeting with our distributors."
Ifemelu was tired, bored. She thought again of starting a blog. Her phone was vibrating, Ranyanudo calling, and ordinarily she would have waited until the meeting was over to call her back, but she said, "Sorry, I have to take this international call," and hurried out. Ranyanudo was complaining about Don.
"He said I'm not the sweet girl I used to be, that I've changed. Meanwhile, I know he has bought the jeep for me and has even cleared it at the port, but now he doesn't want to give it to me."
Ifemelu thought about the expression, "sweet girl." Sweet girl meant that, for a long time, Don had moulded Ranyanudo into a malleable shape, or that she had allowed him to think he had.
"What about Nduti?"
Ranyanudo sighed loudly.
"We haven't talked since Sunday. Today he will forget to call me, tomorrow he will be too busy, and so I told him that it's not acceptable. Why should I be making all the effort? Now he is sulking. He can never initiate a conversation like an adult, or agree that he did something wrong."
Later, back in the office, Esther came in to say that a Mr. Tolu wanted to see the Maie.
"Is that the photographer you did the Taylor's article with?" Doris asked.
"Yes, he's late. He has been dodging my calls for days," the Maie said.
Doris said,
"You need to handle that and make sure I have the images by tomorrow afternoon. I need everything to get to the printer before 3. I don't want a repeat of the printer's delay, especially now that glass is printing in South Africa."
"Okay," Zamaye shook her mouth. "The server is so slow today. I just need to send this thing. Esther, tell him to wait."
"Yes, ma."
"You are feeling better, Esther?"
Doris asked.
"Yes, ma. Thank you, ma."
Esther curtsied, Yoruba style. She had been standing by the door as though waiting to be dismissed, listening in on the conversation.
"I'm taking the medicine for typhoid."
"You have typhoid?" Ifemelu asked.
"Didn't you notice how she looked on Monday? I gave her some money and told her to go to the hospital, not to a chemist," Doris said.
Ifemelu wished that she had noticed that Esther was unwell. "Sorry, Esther," Ifemelu said.
"Thank you, Ma."
"Esther, sorry you," Zamaye said. "I saw her dull face, but I thought she was just fasting. You know she's always fasting. She will fast and fast until God gives her a husband." Esther giggled. "I remember I had this really bad case of typhoid when I was in secondary school," Ifemelu said. "It was terrible. It turned out I was taking an antibiotic that wasn't strong enough. What are you taking, Esther?"
"Medicine, Ma."
"What antibiotic did they give you?"
"I don't know."
"You don't know the name?"
"Let me bring them, Ma."
Esther came back with transparent packets of pills, on which instructions but no names were written, in a crabbed handwriting in blue ink. "Two to be taken morning and night, one to be taken 3 times daily. "We should write about this, Doris. We should have a health column with useful, practical information. Somebody should let the health minister know that ordinary Nigerians go to see a doctor and the doctor gives them unnamed medicines. This can kill you. How will anybody know what you've already taken, or what you shouldn't take if you're already taking something else?"
"Uh-uh, but that one is a small problem. They do it so that you don't buy the medicine from someone else," Zamaye said.
"But what about fake drugs? Go to the market and see what they are selling."
"Okay, let's all calm down. No need to go all activist. We're not doing investigative journalism here," Doris said.
Ifemelu began then to visualize her new blog, a blue and white design, and on the masthead, an aerial shot of a Lagos scene. Nothing familiar, not a traffic clog of yellow rusted buses or a waterlogged slum of zinc shacks. Perhaps the abandoned house next to her flat would do. She would take the photo herself, in the haunted light of early evening, and hope to catch the male peacock in flight. The blog posts would be in a stark, readable font. An article about healthcare, using Esther's story, with pictures of the packets of nameless medicine. A piece about the Nigerpolitan Club. A fashion article about clothes that women could actually afford. Posts about people helping others, but nothing like the Zoe stories that always featured a wealthy person hugging children at a motherless baby's home with bags of rice and tins of powdered milk propped in the background.
"But, Esther, you have to stop all that fasting," Zamaye said. "You know, some months Esther will give her whole salary to her church. They call it sowing a seed. Then she will come and ask me to give her 300 naira for transport."
"But, Ma, it is just small help. You are equal to the task," Esther said, smiling.
"Last week she was fasting with a handkerchief," Zamaye continued. "She kept it on her desk all day. She says somebody in her church got promoted after fasting with a handkerchief."
"Is that what that handkerchief on her table was about?" Ifemelu asked.
"But I believe miracles totally work. I know my aunt was cured of cancer in her church," Doris said.
"With a magic handkerchief, Abi?" Zamaye scoffed.
"You don't believe me, Ma, but it is true."
Esther was enjoying the camaraderie, reluctant to return to her desk.
"So you want a promotion, Esther, which means you want my job?" Zamaye asked.
"No, Ma, all of us will be promoted in Jesus' name," Esther said.
They were all laughing.
"Has Esther told you what spirit you have, Ifemelu?" Zamaye asked, walking to the door.
"When I first started working here, she kept inviting me to her church, and then one day she told me there would be a special prayer service for people with the spirit of seductiveness. People like me."
"That's not, like, entirely far-fetched," Doris said and smirked.
"What is my spirit, Esther?" Ifemelu asked. Esther shook her head, smiling, and left the office. Ifemelu turned to her computer. The title for the blog had just come to her. The Small Redemptions of Lagos.
"I wonder who Zamaye is dating," Doris said.
"She told me she doesn't have a boyfriend."
"Have you seen her car? Her salary can't pay for the light in that car. It's not like her family is rich or anything. I've been working with her almost a year now, and I don't know what she, like, really does."
"Maybe she goes home and changes her clothes and becomes an armed robber at night," Ifemelu said.
"Whatever,"
Doris said.
"We should do a piece about churches," Ifemelu said, "like Esther's church."
"That's not a good fit for Zoe,"
It makes no sense that Auntie Onenu likes to run three profiles of these boring women who have achieved nothing and have nothing to say. Of the younger women with zero talent who have decided that they are fashion designers.
You know they pay Auntie Onenu, right?
Doris asked. They pay her? Ifemelu stared.
No, I didn't know, and you know I didn't know.
Well, they do, most of them. You have to realize a lot of things happen in this country like that.
Ifemelu got up to gather her things.
I never know where you stand, or if you stand on anything at all.
And you are such a judgmental bitch!
Doris screamed, her eyes bulging. Ifemelu, alarmed by the suddenness of the change, thought that perhaps Doris was underneath her retroaffectations, one of those women who could transform when provoked, and tear off their clothes, and fight in the street.
You sit there and judge everyone,
Doris was saying.
Who do you think you are? Why do you think this magazine should be about you? It isn't yours. Auntie Onenu has told you what she wants her magazine to be, and it's either you do it, or you shouldn't be working here.
You need to get yourself a moisturizer, and stop scaring people with that nasty red lipstick. Ifemelu said, and you need to get a life and stop thinking that sucking up to Auntie Onenu and helping her publish a god-awful magazine will open doors for you, because it won't.
She left the office, feeling common, shamed by what had just happened. Perhaps this was a sign to quit now and start her blog. On her way out, Esther said, her voice earnest and low,
Ma, I think you have the spirit of husband repelling. You are too hard, Ma. You will not find a husband. But my pastor can destroy that spirit.
Chapter 50 DK was seeing a therapist 3 times a week. Ifemelu called him every other day, and sometimes he spoke about his session, and other times he did not. But always he wanted to hear about her new life. She told him about her flat, and how she had a driver who drove her to work, and how she was seeing her old friends, and how on Sundays she loved to drive herself because the roads were empty. Lagos became a gentler version of itself, and the people in their bright church clothes looked from far away like flowers in the wind. "You would like Lagos, I think," she said, and he eagerly, surprisingly said, "Can I come visit you, Curse?" Auntie Uju was reluctant at first.
"Lagos, is it safe? You know what he has been through. I don't think he can handle it."
"But he asked to come, Auntie."
"He asked to come? Since when has he known what is good for him? Is he not the same person who wanted to make me childless?"
But Auntie Uju bought DK's ticket, and now here they were, she and DK, in her car, crawling through the crush of traffic in Oshodi. DK looking wide-eyed out of the window.
"Oh my God, Curse! I've never seen so many black people in the same place," he said.
They stopped at a fast food place, where he ordered a hamburger.
"Is this horse meat, Curse? Because it isn't a hamburger."
Afterwards, he would eat only jollof rice and fried plantain. It was auspicious, his arrival, on a day after she put up her blog and a week after she resigned. Auntie Onenu did not seem surprised by her resignation, nor did she try to make her stay.
"Come and give me a hug, my dear," was all she said, smiling vacuously, while Ifemelu's pride soured.
But Ifemelu was full of sanguine expectations for the small redemptions of Lagos, with a dreamy photograph of an abandoned colonial house on its masthead. Her first post was a short interview with Priye, the photographs from weddings Priye had planned. Ifemelu thought most of the decor fussy and overdone, but the post received enthusiastic comments, especially about the decor.
"Fantastic decoration, Madame Priye.
I hope you will do my own wedding."
"Great work. Carry go."
Zemaye had written under a pseudonym a piece about body language and sex. Can you tell if two people are doing it just by looking at them together? That, too, drew many comments. But the most comments by far were for Ifemelu's piece about the Nigerpolitan Club. "Lagos has never been, will never be, and has never aspired to be, like New York, or anywhere else for that matter. Lagos has always been undisputably itself. But you would not know this at the meeting of the Nigerpolitan Club, a group of young returnees
who gather every week to moan about the many ways that Lagos is not like New York, as though Lagos had ever been close to being like New York. Full disclosure, I am one of them. Most of us have come back to make money in Nigeria, to start businesses, to see government contracts and contacts. Others have come with dreams in their pockets and a hunger to change the country. But we spend all our time complaining about Nigeria, and even though our complaints are legitimate, I imagine myself as an outsider saying, "Go back where you came from. If your cook cannot make the perfect panini, it is not because he is stupid, it is because Nigeria is not a nation of sandwich-eating people, and his last ogre did not eat bread in the afternoon, so he needs training and practice. And Nigeria is not a nation of people with food allergies, not a nation of picky eaters for whom food is about distinctions and separations. It is a nation of people who eat beef and chicken and cow skin and intestines and dried fish in a single bowl of soup, and it is called assorted. So get over yourselves and realize that the way of life here is just that, assorted." The first commenter wrote, "Rubbish post, who cares?" And the second wrote, "Thank God somebody is finally talking about this. Now what for arrogance of Nigerian returnees? My cousin came back after 6 years in America, and the other morning she came with me to the nursery school at Unilag where I was dropping off my niece. And near the gate, she saw students standing in line for the bus, and she said, 'Wow, people actually stand in line here.'" Another early commenter wrote, "Why should Nigerians who school abroad have a choice of where to get posted for their National Youth Service? Nigerians who school in Nigeria are randomly posted, so why shouldn't Nigerians who school abroad be treated the same way?" That comment sparked more responses than the original post had. By the sixth day, the blog had 1,000 unique visitors. Ifemelu moderated the comments, deleting anything obscene, reveling in the liveliness of it all, in the sense of herself at the surging forefront of something vibrant. She wrote a long post about the expensive lifestyles of some young women in Lagos, and a day after she put it up, Ranyinudo called her, furious, her breathing heavy over the phone. "Ifem, how can you do this kind of thing? Anyone who knows me will know it's me." "That's not true, Ranyi. Your story is so common. What are you saying? It's obviously me. Look at this." Ranyinudo paused, and then began to read aloud. "There are many young women in Lagos with unknown sources of wealth. They live lives they can't afford. They have only ever traveled business class to Europe, but have jobs that can't even afford them a regular flight ticket. One of them is my friend, a beautiful, brilliant woman who works in advertising. She lives on the island and is dating a big man banker. I worry that she will end up like many women in Lagos who define their lives by men they can never truly have, crippled by their culture of dependence, with desperation in their eyes and designer handbags on their wrists." "Ranyi, honestly, nobody will know it's you. All the comments so far have been from people saying that they identify. So many women lose themselves in relationships like that. What I really had in mind was Auntie Uju and the General. That relationship destroyed her. She became a different person because of the General, and she couldn't do anything for herself, and when he died, she lost herself." "And who are you to pass judgment? How is it different from you and the rich white guy in America? Would you have your U.S. citizenship today, if not for him? How did you get your job in America? You need to stop this nonsense. Stop feeling so superior." Ranyinudo hung up on her. For a long time, Ifemelu stared at the silent phone, shaken. Then she took down the post and drove over to Ranyinudo's place. "Ranyi, I'm sorry. Please don't be angry," she said. Ranyinudo gave her a long look. "You're right," Ifemelu said. "It's easy to be judgmental, but it was not personal, and it was not coming from a bad place. Please be cool. I will never invade your privacy like that again." Ranyinudo shook her head. "Ifemelu Nama, your problem is emotional frustration. Go and find Obinze, please." Ifemelu laughed. It was what she least expected to hear. "I have to lose weight first," she said. "You're just afraid." Before Ifemelu left, they sat on the couch and drank malt and watched the latest celebrity news on E! DK volunteered to moderate the blog comments so that she could take a break.
"Oh my God, 'cause people take this stuff really personal,"
he said. Sometimes he laughed aloud on reading a comment. Other times he asked her what unfamiliar expressions meant.
What's shine your eye?
The first time the power went off after he arrived, the buzzing, whirring, piping sounds of her UPS startled him.
Oh my God, is that like a fire alarm?
He asked.
No, that's just something that makes sure my TV doesn't get destroyed by crazy power cuts. That's crazy, DK said.
But only days later, he was going to the back of the flat to turn on the generator himself when the power went off. Rania Nudo brought her cousins to meet him, girls who were close to his age, skinny jeans clinging to their slender hips, their budding breasts outlined in tight T-shirts.
DK, you must marry one of them, Rania Nudo said. We need fine children in our family.
Rani,
her cousins said, abashed, hiding their shyness. They liked DK. It was so easy to like him, with his charm and his humor, and the vulnerability openly lurking underneath. On Facebook he posted a picture Ifemelu had taken of him, standing on the veranda with Rania Nudo's cousins, and he captioned it, "No lions yet to eat me, folks." "I wish I spoke Igbo," he told her, after they had spent an evening with her parents. "But you understand perfectly," she said.
"I just wish I spoke."
"You can still learn," she said, suddenly feeling desperate, unsure how much this mattered to him, thinking again of him lying on the couch in the basement, drenched in sweat. She wondered if she should say more or not.
"Yeah, I guess so,"
he said, and shrugged, as though to say it was already too late. Some days before he left, he asked her,
"What was my father really like?"
"He loved you."
"Did you like him?"
She did not want to lie. "I don't know. He was a big man in a military government, and that does something to you, and the way you relate to people. I was worried for your mum because I thought she deserved better. But she loved him. She really did, and he loved you. He used to carry you with such tenderness."
"I can't believe Mom hid from me for so long that she was his mistress."
"She was protecting you," Ifemelu said.
"Can we go see the house in Dolphin Estate?"
"Yes." She drove him to Dolphin Estate, astounded by how much it had declined. The paint was peeling on buildings, the streets pitted with potholes, and the whole estate resigned to its own shabbiness. "It was so much nicer then," she told him. He stood looking at the house for a while, until the gateman said,
"Yes, any problem?"
And they got back into the car.
"Can I drive, Kurz?"
he asked.
"Are you sure?"
He nodded. She came out of the driver's seat and went around to his. He drove them home, hesitating slightly before he merged onto Osborne Road, and then easing into traffic with more confidence. She knew it meant something to him that she could not name. That night when the power went off, her generator would not come on, and she suspected that her driver Io had been sold diesel spiked with kerosene. DK complained about the heat, about mosquitoes biting him. She opened the windows, made him take off his shirt, and they lay side by side in bed, talking, desultory talking, and she reached out and touched his forehead and left her hand there until she heard the gentle, even breathing of his sleep. In the morning, the sky was overcast with slate-grey clouds, the air thick with rains foreboding. From nearby, a clutch of birds screeched and flew away. The rain would come down, a sea unleashed from the sky, and DSTV images would get grainy, phone networks would clog, the roads would flood, and traffic would gnarl. She stood with DK on the veranda as the early droplets came down.
"I kind of like it here,"
he told her. She wanted to say, "You can live with me. There are good private schools here that you could go to." But she did not. She took him to the airport and stayed watching until he went past security, waved, and turned the corner. Back home, she heard the hollowness in her steps as she walked from bedroom to living room to veranda and then back again. Later, Rania Nudo told her,
"I don't understand how a fine boy like Dickie would want to kill himself. A boy living in America with everything. How can? That is very foreign behavior.
Foreign behavior? What the fuck are you talking about, foreign behavior? Have you read Things Fall Apart? Ifemelu asked, wishing she had not told Ranyinudo about Dike. She was angrier with Ranyinudo than she had ever been, yet she knew that Ranyinudo meant well, and had said what many other Nigerians would say, which was why she had not told anyone else about Dike's suicide attempt since she came back. Chapter 51. It had terrified her, the first time she came to the bank, to walk past the armed security guard and into the beeping door, where she stood in the enclosure, sealed and airless like a standing coffin, until the light changed to green. Had banks always had this ostentatious security? Before she left America, she had wired some money to Nigeria, and Bank of America had made her speak to three different people, each one telling her that Nigeria was a high-risk country. If anything happened to her money, they would not be responsible. Did she understand? The last woman she spoke to made her repeat herself.
"Ma'am, I'm sorry I didn't hear you. I need to know that you understand that Nigeria is a high-risk country."
"I understand," she said. They read her caveat after caveat, and she began to fear for her money, snaking its way through the air to Nigeria. And she worried even more when she came to the bank and saw the gaudy garlands of security at the entrance. But the money was safely in her account. And now, as she walked into the bank, she saw Obinze at the customer service section. He was standing with his back to her, and she knew from the height and the shape of the head that it was him. She stopped, sick with apprehension, hoping he would not turn just yet, until she had gathered her nerves. Then he turned, and it was not Obinze. Her throat felt tight. Her head was filled with ghosts. Back in her car, she turned on the air conditioner and decided to call him, to free herself of the ghosts. His phone rang and rang. He was a big man now. He would not, of course, pick up a call from an unknown number. She sent a text. "Ceiling, it's me." Her phone rang almost immediately.
"Hello, Ifem."
That voice she had not heard in so long, and it sounded both changed and unchanged.
"Ceiling, how are you?"
"You're back."
"Yes." Her hands were trembling. She should have sent an email first. She should be chatty, ask about his wife and child, tell him that she had, in fact, been back for a while.
"So?"
Obinze said, dragging the word. "How are you? Where are you? When can I see you? What about now?" The recklessness that often emerged when she felt nervous had pushed out those words. But perhaps it was best to see him right away and get it over with. She wished she had dressed up a bit more, maybe worn her favorite wrap dress with its slimming cut. But her knee-length skirt was not too bad, and her high heels always made her feel confident, and her afro was thankfully not yet too shrunken from the humidity. There was a pause on Obinze's end, something hesitant, which made her regret her rashness.
"I'm actually running a bit late for a meeting," she added quickly, "but I just wanted to say hi, and we can meet up soon."
"Ifem, where are you?"
She told him she was on her way to Jazz Hole to buy a book, and would be there in a few minutes. Half an hour later, she was standing in front of the bookshop when a black Range Rover pulled in, and Obinze got out from the back. There was a moment, a caving of the blue sky, an inertia of stillness, when neither of them knew what to do. He walking towards her, she standing there squinting. And then he was upon her, and they hugged. She thumped him on the back once, twice, to make it a chummy-chummy hug, a platonic and safe chummy-chummy hug. But he pulled her ever so slightly close to him, and held her for a moment too long, as though to say he was not being chummy-chummy.
"Obinze, Madwe, we see. Long time. Look at you, you haven't changed."
She was flustered, and the new shrillness in her voice annoyed her. He was looking at her, an open, unabashed looking, and she would not hold his gaze. Her fingers were shaking of their own accord, which was bad enough. She did not need to stare into his eyes, both of them standing there, in the hot sun, in the fumes of traffic from a Wallowa road.
"It's so good to see you, Ifem," he said.
He was calm. She had forgotten what a calm person he was. There was still in his bearing a trace of his teenage history. The one who didn't try too hard. The one the girls wanted, and the boys wanted to be.
"You're bald," she said.
He laughed and touched his head.
"Yes, mostly by choice."
He had filled out, from the slight boy of their university days, to a fleshier, more muscled man. And perhaps because he had filled out, he seemed shorter than she remembered. In her high heels, she was taller than he was. She had not forgotten, but merely remembered anew, how understated his manner was. His plain dark jeans, his leather slippers, the way he walked into the bookshop with no need to dominate it.
"Let's sit down," he said.
The bookshop was dimly cool, its air moody and eclectic. Books, CDs and magazines spread out on low shelves. A man standing near the entrance nodded at them in welcome, while adjusting the large headphones around his head. They sat opposite each other, in the tiny cafe at the back, and ordered fruit juice. Obinze put his two phones on the table. They lit up often, ringing in silent mode, and he would dance at them, and then away. He worked out, she could tell from the firmness of his chest, across which stretched the double front pockets of his fitted shirt.
"You've been back for a while," he said.
He was watching her again, and she remembered how she had often felt as if he could see her mind, knew things about her that she might not consciously know.
"Yes," she said. "So, what did you come to buy?"
"What?"
"The book you wanted to buy."
"Actually, I just wanted to meet you here. I thought, if it turns out that seeing you again is something I'd like to remember, then I want to remember it in Jazz Hall."
"I want to remember it in Jazz Hall,"
he repeated, smiling as though only she could have come up with that expression.
"You haven't stopped being honest, Ifem. Thank God."
"I already think I'm going to want to remember this." Her nervousness was melting away. They had raced past the requisite moments of awkwardness.
"Do you need to be anywhere right now?"
he asked.
"Can you stay a while?"
"Yes." He switched off both his phones, a rare declaration in a city like Lagos for a man like him, that she had his absolute attention.
"How is Dike? How is Auntie Uju?"
"They're fine. He's doing well now. He actually came to visit me here. He only just left." The waitress served tall cups of mango orange juice.
"What has surprised you the most about being back?"
he asked.
"Everything, honestly. I started wondering if something was wrong with me."
"Oh, it's normal," he said. And she remembered how he had always been quick to reassure her, to make her feel better.
"I was away for a much shorter time, obviously, but I was very surprised when I came back. I kept thinking that things should have waited for me, but they hadn't.
I'd forgotten that Lagos is so expensive. I can't believe how much money the Nigerian wealthy spend."
"Most of them are thieves or beggars."
She laughed.
"Thieves or beggars. It's true. And they don't just spend a lot. They expect to spend a lot. I met this guy the other day, and he was telling me how he started his satellite dish business about 20 years ago. This was when satellite dishes were still new in the country, and so he was bringing in something most people didn't know about. He put his business plan together and came up with a good price that would fetch him a good profit. Another friend of his, who was already a businessman and was going to invest in the business, took a look at the price and asked him to double it. Otherwise, he said, the Nigerian wealthy would not buy. He doubled it, and it worked."
"Crazy," she said.
"Maybe it's always been this way, and we didn't know because we couldn't know.
It's as if we are looking at an adult Nigeria that we didn't know about.
Yes.
He liked the way she had said, we, she could tell. And she liked that we had slipped so easily out of her.
It's such a transactional city, she said, depressingly transactional. Even relationships, they're all transactional.
Some relationships.
Yes,
some, she agreed.
They were telling each other something that neither could yet articulate. Because she felt the nervousness creeping up her fingers again, she turned to humour.
And there is a certain bombast in the way we speak that I'd also forgotten. I started feeling truly at home again when I started being bombastic.
Obinze laughed. She liked his quiet laugh.
When I came back, I was shocked at how quickly my friends had all become fat, with big beer bellies. I thought, what is happening? Then I realized that they were the new middle class that our democracy created. They had jobs and they could afford to drink a lot more beer and to eat out. And you know, eating out for us here is chicken and chips. And so they got fat.
Ifemelu's stomach clenched.
Well, if you look carefully, you'll notice it's not only your friends.
Oh no, Ifem, you're not fat. You're being very American about that. What Americans consider fat can just be normal.
You need to see my guys to know what I'm talking about. Remember Uche Koye, even Okudiba? They can't even button their shirts now.
Obinze paused.
You put on some weight, and it suits you,
Imaka. She felt shy, a pleasant shyness, hearing him say she was beautiful.
You used to tease me about not having an ass, she said. I take my words back. At the door, I waited for you to go ahead for a reason.
They laughed, and then, laughter tapering off, were silent, smiling at each other in the strangeness of their intimacy. She remembered how, as she got up naked from his mattress on the floor in Nsukka, he would look up and say,
I was going to say shake it, but there's nothing to shake.
And she would playfully kick him in the shin. The clarity of that memory, the sudden stab of longing it brought, left her unsteady.
But talk of being surprised, Ceiling, she said. Look at you, big man with your Range Rover. Having money must have really changed things.
Yes, I guess it has.
Oh, come on, she said. How?
People treat you differently. I don't just mean strangers. Friends, too. Even my cousin, Neoma. Suddenly you're getting all of this sucking up from people because they think you expect it. All this exaggerated politeness, exaggerated praise, even exaggerated respect that you haven't earned at all. And it's so fake and so garish. It's like a bad, over-colored painting. But sometimes you start believing a little bit of it yourself, and sometimes you see yourself differently. One day I went to a wedding in my hometown, and the MC was doing a lot of silly praise singing when I came in. And I realized I was walking differently. I didn't want to walk differently, but I was.
What, like a swagger? She teased. Show me the walk.
You'll have to sing my praises first.
He sipped his drink. Nigerians can be so obsequious. We are a confident people, but we are so obsequious. It's not difficult for us to be insincere.
We have confidence, but no dignity.
Yes.
He looked at her. Recognition in his eyes.
And if you keep getting that overdone sucking up, it makes you paranoid. You don't know if anything is honest or true anymore. And then people become paranoid for you, but in a different way. My relatives are always telling me, be careful where you eat. Even in Lagos, my friends tell me to watch what I eat. Don't eat in a woman's house because you put something in your food.
And do you?
Do I what?
Watch what you eat.
I wouldn't in your house.
A pause. He was being openly flirtatious, and she was unsure what to say.
But no, he continued. I like to think that if I wanted to eat in somebody's house, it would be a person who would not think of slipping jazz into my food.
It all seems really desperate.
One of the things I've learned is that everybody in this country has a mentality of scarcity.
We imagine that even the things that are not scarce are scarce, and it breeds a kind of desperation in everybody, even the wealthy.
The wealthy like you, that is, she quipped.
He paused. He often paused before he spoke. She thought this exquisite. It was as though he had such regard for his listener that he wanted his words strung together in the best possible way.
I like to think I don't have that desperation. I sometimes feel as if the money I have isn't really mine, as if I'm holding it for someone else for a while. After I bought my property in Dubai, it was my first property outside Nigeria, I felt almost frightened. And when I told Okudiba how I felt, he said I was crazy and I should stop behaving as if life is one of the novels I read. He was so impressed by what I owned, and I just felt as if my life had become this layer of pretension after pretension, and I started to get sentimental about the past. I would think about when I was staying with Okudiba in his first small flat in Surulere, and how we would heat the iron on the stove when NEPA took light, and how his neighbor downstairs used to shout, "Praise the Lord!" whenever the light came back, and how even for me, there was something so beautiful about the light coming back, when it's out of your control because you don't have a generator. But it's a silly sort of romance, because of course I don't want to go back to that life.
She looked away, worried that the crush of emotion she had felt while he was speaking would now converge on her face. "Of course you don't. You like your life," she said.
"I live my life."
"Oh, how mysterious we are.
What about you, famous race blogger, Princeton fellow? How have you changed?"
he asked, smiling, leaning towards her with his elbows on the table. "When I was babysitting in undergrad, one day I heard myself telling the kid I was babysitting, 'You're such a trooper.'
Is there another word more American than trooper?"
Obinze was laughing.
"That's when I thought, yes, I may have changed a little."
She said,
"You don't have an American accent."
"I made an effort not to."
"I was surprised when I read the archives of your blog. It didn't sound like you."
"I really don't think I've changed that much, though."
"Oh, you've changed,"
he said, with a certitude that she instinctively disliked.
"How?" "I don't know. You're more self-aware, maybe more guarded."
"You sound like a disappointed uncle."
"No."
Another one of his pauses, but this time he seemed to be holding back.
"But your blog also made me proud. I thought, she's gone. She's learned, and she's conquered."
Again she felt shy.
"I don't know about conquering."
"Your aesthetics changed, too," he said. "What do you mean?"
"Did you cure your own meats in America?"
"What?"
"I read a piece about this new movement among the American privileged classes, where people want to drink milk straight from the cow and that sort of thing. I thought maybe you're into that now that you wear a flower in your hair."
She burst out laughing.
"But really, tell me how you've changed."
His tone was teasing, yet she tensed slightly at his question. It seemed too close to her vulnerable soft core. And so she said in a breezy voice, "My taste, I guess. I can't believe how much I find ugly now. I can't stand most of the houses in this city. I'm now a person who has learned to admire exposed wooden rafters." She rolled her eyes, and he smiled at her self-mockery, a smile that seemed to her like a prize that she wanted to win over and over again. "It's really a kind of snobbery," she added.
"It's snobbery, not a kind," he said. "I used to have that about books, secretly feeling that your taste is superior."
"The problem is, I'm not always secret about it." He laughed.
"Oh, we know that."
"You said you used to? What happened?"
"What happened was that I grew up."
"Ouch," she said. He said nothing. The slight sardonic raise of his eyebrows said that she, too, would have to grow up.
What are you reading these days? She asked. I'm sure you've read every American novel ever published.
I've been reading a lot more non-fiction, history and biographies. About everything, not just America.
What? You fell out of love?
I realized I could buy America, and it lost its shine. When all I had was my passion for America, they didn't give me a visa. But with my new bank account, getting a visa was very easy. I visited a few times. I was looking into buying property in Miami.
She felt a pang. He had visited America and she had not known. So, what did you finally make of your dream country?
I remember when you first went to Manhattan and you wrote to me and said, "It's wonderful, but it's not heaven." I thought of that when I took my first cab ride in Manhattan.
She remembered writing that too, not long before she stopped contacting him, before she pushed him behind many walls. "The best thing about America is that it gives you space. I like that. I like that you buy into the dream. It's a lie, but you buy into it, and that's all that matters." He looked down at his glass, uninterested in her philosophizing. And she wondered if what she had seen in his eyes was resentment, if he too was remembering how she had so completely shut him out. When he asked, "Are you still friends with your old friends?" she thought it a question about whom else she had shut out all these years. She wondered whether to bring it up herself, whether to wait for him to. She should bring it up. She owed him that. But a wordless fear had seized her. A fear of breaking delicate things. "With Ranyi Nudo, yes, and Priye. The others are now people who used to be my friends. Kind of like you and Emenike. You know, when I read your emails, I wasn't surprised that Emenike turned out like that. There was always something about him." He shook his head and finished his drink. He had earlier put the straw aside, sipping from the glass. "Once, I was with him in London, and he was mocking this guy he worked with, a Nigerian guy, for not knowing how to pronounce F-E-A-T-H-E-R-S-T-O-N-E-H-A-U-G-H. He pronounced it phonetically, like the guy had, which was obviously the wrong way. And he didn't say it the right way. I didn't know how to pronounce it either, and he knew I didn't know. And there were these horrible minutes when he pretended we were both laughing at the guy, when of course we weren't. He was laughing at me, too. I remember it as the moment when I realized he just had never been my friend. "He's an asshole," she said. "Asshole. Very American word." "Is it?"
He half raised his eyebrows, as though there was no need to state the obvious. "Emenike didn't contact me at all after I was deported. Then, last year, after somebody must have told him I was now in the game, he started calling me."
Obinze said, "in the game," in a voice thick with mockery.
"He kept asking if there were any deals we could do together, that kind of nonsense. And one day I told him I really preferred his condescension, and he hasn't called me since."
"What of Kayode?"
"We're in touch. He has a child with an American woman."
Obinze looked at his watch and picked up his phones.
"I hate to go, but I have to."
"Yes, me too." She wanted to prolong this moment, sitting amid the scent of books, discovering Obinze again. Before they got into their separate cars, they hugged, both murmuring, "So good to see you." And she imagined his driver and her driver watching them curiously.
"I'll call you tomorrow," he said.
But she had hardly settled into the car when her phone beeped with a new text message from him.
"Are you free to have lunch tomorrow?"
She was free. It was a Saturday, and she should ask why he would not be with his wife and child, and she should initiate a conversation about what they were doing, exactly. But they had a history. A connection thick as twine, and it did not have to mean that they were doing anything, or that a conversation was necessary. and so she opened the door when he rang the bell, and he came in and admired the flowers on her veranda, the white lilies that rose from the pots like swans.
I spent the morning reading the small redemptions of Lagos, scouring it, actually,
he said. She felt pleased. What did you think?
I like the Nigerpolitan Club post. A little self-righteous, though.
I'm not sure how to take that.
As truth?
He said, with that half-raising of an eyebrow that had to be a new quirk. She did not remember him doing it in the past.
But it's a fantastic blog. It's brave and intelligent. I love the layout.
There he was again, reassuring her. She pointed at the compound next door. Do you recognize that?
Ah, yes. I thought it would be just perfect for the blog. Such a beautiful house, and in this kind of a magnificent ruin, plus peacocks on the roof. It looks a little like a courthouse. I'm always fascinated by these old houses and the stories they carry.
He tugged at the thin metal railing of her veranda, as though to check how durable it was, how safe, and she liked that he did that.
Somebody's going to snap it up soon, tear it down, and put up a gleaming block of overpriced luxury flats.
Somebody like you.
When I started in real estate, I considered renovating old houses instead of tearing them down. But it didn't make sense. Nigerians don't buy houses because they're old. A renovated 200-year-old mill granary, you know, the kind of thing Europeans like, it doesn't work here at all. But of course it makes sense, because we are third worlders, and third worlders are forward-looking. We like things to be new, because our best is still ahead. While in the West, their best is already past, and so they have to make a fetish of that past.
Is it me, or are you now given to delivering little lectures? She asked.
It's just refreshing to have an intelligent person to talk to.
She looked away, wondering if this was a reference to his wife, and disliking him for it.
Your blog already has such a following,
he said. I have big plans for it. I'd like to travel through Nigeria and post dispatches from each state with pictures and human stories, but I have to do things slowly first, establish it, make some money from advertising.
You need investors.
I don't want your money, she said, a little sharply, keeping her eyes levelly on the sunken roof of the abandoned house. She was irritated by his comment about an intelligent person, because it had to be about his wife. And she wanted to ask why he was telling her that. Why had he married a woman who was not intelligent, only to turn around and tell her that his wife was not intelligent?
Look at the peacock, Ifem,
he said gently, as though he sensed her irritation. They watched the peacock walk out of the shadow of a tree, then its lugubrious flight up to its favourite perch on the roof, where it stood and surveyed the decayed kingdom below.
How many are there?
He asked. One male and two females. I've been hoping to see the male do its mating dance, but I never have. They wake me up in the morning with their cries. Have you heard them? Almost like a child that doesn't want to do something. The peacock's slender neck moved this way and that, and then, as though it had heard her, it cawed, its beak parted wide, the sounds pouring out of its throat.
You were right about the sound,
he said, moving closer to her.
Something of a child about it.
The compound reminds me of a property I have in Enugu, an old house. It was built before the war, and I bought it to tear it down, but then I decided to keep it. It's very gracious and restful. Big verandas and old frangipani trees in the back. I'm redoing the interior completely, so it will be very modern inside, but the outside has its old look. Don't laugh. But when I saw it, it reminded me of poetry. There was a boyishness in the way he said, "Don't laugh," that made her smile at him, half making fun of him, half letting him know she liked the idea of a house that had reminded him of poetry.
I imagine one day, when I run away from it all, I'll go and live there, he said.
People really do become eccentric when they become rich.
Or maybe we all have eccentricity in us, We just don't have the money to show it. I'd love to take you to see the house.
She murmured something, a vague acquiescence. His phone had been ringing for a while, an endless dull buzzing in his pocket. Finally he brought it out, glanced at it, and said,
"Sorry, I have to take this."
She nodded and went inside, wondering if it was his wife. From the living room, she heard snatches of his voice, raised, lowered, and then raised again, speaking Igbo. And when he came inside, there was a tightening in his jaw.
"Everything okay?" she asked. "It's a boy from my hometown. I pay his school fees. But he now has a mad sense of entitlement, and this morning he sent me a text telling me he needs a mobile phone, and could I send it to him by Friday? A 15-year-old boy. The gall of it. And then he starts calling me. So I just told him off, and I've told him his scholarship is off too, just to scare some sense into his head."
"Is he related to you?"
"No."
She waited, expecting more.
"Ifem, I do what rich people are supposed to do. I pay school fees for 100 students in my village and my mom's village."
He spoke with an awkward indifference. This was not a subject that he cared to talk about. He was standing by her bookshelf.
"What a beautiful living room."
"Thank you."
"You shipped all your books back?"
"Most of them."
"Ah, Derek Walcott.
I love him. I finally get some poetry."
"I see Graham Greene."
"I started reading him because of your mother. I loved The Heart of the Matter.
I tried reading it after she died. I wanted to love it. I thought, maybe if I could just love it."
He touched the book, his voice trailing away. His wistfulness moved her. "It's real literature, the kind of human story people will read in 200 years, she said.
"You sound just like my mother," he said.
He felt familiar and unfamiliar at the same time. Through the parted curtains, a crescent of light fell across the living room. They were standing by the bookshelf, and she was telling him about the first time she finally read The Heart of the Matter. And he was listening, in that intense manner of his, as though swallowing her words like a drink. They were standing by the bookshelf and laughing about how often his mother had tried to get him to read the book. And then they were standing by the bookshelf and kissing. A gentle kiss at first, lips pressed to lips. Then their tongues were touching, and she felt boneless against him. He pulled away first. "I don't have condoms," she said, brazen, deliberately brazen.
"I didn't know we needed condoms to have lunch."
She hit him playfully. Her entire body was invaded by millions of uncertainties. She did not want to look at his face. "I have a girl who cleans and cooks, so I have a lot of stew in my freezer and jollof rice in my fridge. We can have lunch here. Would you like something to drink?" She turned towards the kitchen.
"What happened in America?"
he asked.
"Why did you just cut off contact?"
Ifemelu kept walking to the kitchen.
"Why did you just cut off contact?"
he repeated quietly.
"Please, tell me what happened."
Before she sat opposite him, at her small dining table, and told him about the corrupt-eyed tennis coach in Ardmore, Pennsylvania, she poured them both some mango juice from a carton. She told him small details about the man's office that were still fresh in her mind. The stacks of sports magazines, the smell of damp. But when she got to the part where he took her to his room, she said simply, "I took off my clothes and did what he asked me to do. I couldn't believe that I got wet. I hated him. I hated myself. I really hated myself. I felt like I had, I don't know, betrayed myself." She paused. "And you." For many long minutes, he said nothing, his eyes downcast, as though absorbing the story. I don't really think about it much, she added. I remember it, but I don't dwell on it. I don't let myself dwell on it. It's so strange.